Welcome to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. This week, the Atlanta-based theater director Kenny Leon opens his latest production on Broadway. It's a revival of Children of a Lesser God, a play that was celebrated by critics and audiences and won a number of major awards when it debuted almost 40 years ago. You may know it from the film production of the play, which starred William Hurt and Merrilee Maitland. This will be Kenny's 10th Broadway show. In 2014, he won the Tony Award for Best Director for his production of Raisin in the Sun, which starred Denzel Washington. Kenny first came to national attention in 1988 when he was named the first African-American artistic director of a major regional theater, the Alliance Theater here in Atlanta. When he took that job, he said his mission would be to produce plays that gave the diverse Atlanta community an understanding of how much we all have in common as human beings. As you'll hear in our conversation, that continues to be his mission today. I talked with Kenny in the Two Way Street studio on the day before he left for New York to begin rehearsals for Children of a Lesser God. Kenny Leon, thanks for being here for Two Way Street. It's great to see you.
Always great to see you.
So let's start with our conversation by talking a bit about Children of a Lesser God. It was originally staged on Broadway. Mark Medoff wrote it. Did it open in 79 or 80? Played for a couple of years.
Yeah. And they won the Tony Award in 1980. Medoff wrote it for his friend Phyllis Frelick, who was a friend of his who was deaf. And it had an amazing run. And then they turned that play into a film. Popular film, but it was originally a play, and at its core, it's a very intimate, beautiful, wonderful play. I was introduced to the play by Craig Zaden and Neil Marin, who were producing the play first, and at that time, we approached Tom Cruise to do the play, because at that time, I thought the play was white actors and actresses, and I was excited that the industry not only approached me to do the great African-American stories, but here they were approaching me to do this Anglo-American story about a hearing teacher and a deaf woman who worked at the school. And so, you know, long story short, Cruise ended up not doing it, and that production of the play fell away. A couple of years later, Hal Luftick, who produced Kinky Boots on Broadway, approached me because he had attained the rights, and he says, "I want to do this play because it's about other. Anybody that's an other, you know, if you're black, if you're gay, if you're deaf, that's what it's about." And I said, "Yeah, you're right. It's a love story about other. Okay, cool." So, but I still was excited to do this play, and I'm thinking like it still be other, but all the other included. Just white people.
White people, sure. Because that's what it had been in the past.
The success of the play and the film.
The film was William Hurt played the teacher.
Right.
Marley Maitland played the deaf woman. She won her Academy Award for that picture. But it was a white story.
Yeah. And it won the Tony Award, and the actors on Broadway won Tonys. And so long story short, I knew that there was at least one deaf character in the play, the woman. And so I was like, you know what? I need to try to learn sign language or just a little bit. And I called a friend in Boston, and he says, "Look, Kenny, you're gonna learn sign language. You should learn it from a deaf person. Don't learn it from a hearing person, because I think you're capable of learning it from a deaf person. It's going to be more challenging, but that's the best way to learn it. And here are two people." And I flipped a coin, and it landed on heads, and heads was this woman named Lauren Ridloff. And so I was going to meet her for the first time in Brooklyn at a coffee bar. And she had Googled me, so she knew exactly what I looked like. I had no idea what she looked like. But in my own prejudice, I said, "This woman is white, 65, 70 years old. She's bland. She has on bland clothes. That's what a deaf person was to me. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say that, but I was like, wow, that's what I was thinking in my head. Like, okay, she's 65, 70 years old with glasses, and she's not an interesting person. So I'm going in the coffee bar looking for that person. In the center of the coffee shop was Lauren Ridloff, who was African-American, 36, 37 years old, looked like a model. And she's calling me to her.
Like, she had been, in fact, a model at one point in her life, I think, and also yes. Was Miss Deaf America, correct?
Correct, correct. But I didn't know that at that time. Yeah. I just knew that this was a stay-at-home mom with two deaf kids who's meeting me in this coffee bar. And she's waving, motioning for me to come over to her. And I went over to her, and she started signing, you know, what do you want to eat, and showing me the symbols of eat. I was like, oh, that's eat. And then it's like drink and coffee. And so it was just wonderful. That was my first lesson. And then at the end of the lesson, she would text something on the phone for me to study as my homework. Then the next week, we would go to the museum, and we would learn color, all the colors and the signs for that. And she would never teach me the alphabet because she didn't want me to learn, have shortcuts to spell everything out. So a year later, every Tuesday for a year in Brooklyn, I took lessons from her.
Okay, so in the meantime, mm-hmm. while you're taking lessons from her, you're also beginning to think about the production and you're starting to cast the show.
Right.
And I think you fairly quickly arrived on Joshua Jackson to play the teacher.
We were looking for the cast, and I felt like Lauren would be able to help me with the deaf community or the harder hearing community.
In terms of finding an actress?
No, just in terms of, like I said, at some point I thought she could be around to tell us what's disrespectful to that community. She can tell us, you're going to need to put subtitles in, just a way that we could be engaged into the deaf community.
Sure.
and be respectful for that. But at that time, as we were gearing up for Broadway or gearing up for a workshop for Broadway, I had reached out to Joshua Jackson because Joshua and I had worked on Smart People off Broadway.
Yeah.
And we had a great experience.
And Joshua Jackson and Dawson Creek,
he's from a show called The Affair.
The Affair on Showtime.
He's a great actor.
Yeah.
And he's like, it was such a great experience. I just want to do a Broadway show with you. I was like, absolutely.
But so, you, in the meantime, are looking for a woman. Mark Medoff had said when he wrote this play, I want the part of the young woman to be played by a deaf actress. That was one of his instructions. So you had to go out and look for a deaf actress to play the part, yes?
Yeah, that's like a no-brainer. I mean, anyone that does this play without involving the deaf community on stage, I think making a huge mistake. So
okay. That
is, he talks about that at the in the preface of his script.
Right.
But that's the way I think anyway. So Josh is like, okay. And he didn't know if he loved to play or not. He just says, I want to do a Broadway play with Kenny. And during that time, a year later, I'm like, maybe Lauren could do this play. And the producers were like, right. But, okay, she'll just do the workshop, but then we'll go and find
a
real actress.
Because
there's thousands of actors, especially since the initial Children of a Lesser God. There are thousands and thousands of wonderful deaf actresses in the country. So, they want to know, why you want to go with this person who's not an actress? And I was like, well, I think she had something that she has everything the character has. And the interesting thing was, that was the first time I thought about the woman being African-American. And then I was like, why can't she be African-American? And I got Joshua Jackson playing opposite her. And so then it becomes a racial thing. Then it works on a couple levels. It's like black and white, and it works on hearing, not hearing. And then once I did that, I was like, oh, well, okay, who would play her mother? Well, probably her mother's African-American. So then I ended up casting African-American as a mother. And then John McGinty, who's a great deaf actor, came on to play Oren. And, we put this thing together. And long story short, it was, and I had an Asian-American playing the lawyer. So I said, what does it feel like for a second-generation Asian to represent the other that is deaf? So then the play started changing for me. It no longer was a play about two people falling in love and communication being the barrier. Now it is a play about how we all pretend we're God and we try to make each other over and try to pass that off as communication.
This is pure Kenny Leon, in the sense that you think completely differently about how to put a show together. When you did your first Broadway production of Raisin in the Sun, 10 years later, you won your Tony as Best Director for the second production, but you did it 10 years earlier, and instead, and the part of Walter is such an iconic role, and instead of casting a powerful young African-American actor, you went to the hip-hop world and cast Walter with who?
With Sean P. Diddy Combs.
This is how you think, Kenny Leon.
Well, it just ended up that way. You know, I gave him a shot because, you know, we needed a name to sell the show. But at that time, what people don't really realize, we tried to go out to every African-American who was the right age, who would give us something for the show, and they all felt that A Raisin in the Sun was old. Oh. It was not a fresh play. And that's one thing as African-American artists, we have to do better at. We have to revisit these works and make them fresh for a new generation. A lot of African-American work is sort of didactic and specific to the period.
So we come back to casting Lauren Ridloff, a non-actress, taking a chance on her as you had on P. Diddy in Raisin. Mm-hmm. And we pointed out that the New York Times found a way up to the Berkshires to review it. And Jesse Green, writing in the Times, calls her a sensational find, her signing so explosive we barely need the translation. The Boston Globe says she's remarkable. She's become one of the most celebrated young actresses in the theater right now, starting without an acting background at all.
Absolutely. I think our job as directors is one is to be able to recognize talent, and two, to be able to recognize talent that may not be all the way there, but we're able to get them where they need to be. You know, if I look at my work on The Wiz Live, you know, we had Shanice Williams, who hadn't ever done a professional show. You mentioned Puffy doing his first play. So, you know, it's always about trying to find the right person and being able to look in non-traditional places to find that. You have to have an opening. With Lauren, I was open, my mind was open enough to see that she had everything that we needed.
You were quoted in one of the articles written about the Berkshires production as saying of her, you can hear her hands speak.
Oh, absolutely. I've learned a lot from her and from that community. In my rehearsal room, I got three interpreters. I have a director of sign language. So we have a beautiful time in rehearsal. So I've grown as a person by being exposed to the deaf community. I'm a better person. And to be
six. Why are you a better person? What is being exposed to the deaf community taught you?
Because it tells me that we marginalize people and we push people away. We push beauty away. We push intellect away if we don't understand it. You know, it's like, oh, she's deaf. She couldn't possibly have anything to offer. We try to make them over. Like, we try to say, why didn't she learn how to speak? Even though someone like Lauren, they have never, ever heard the human voice. So now they're living life on your terms. It sounds good to you. She has no idea how that sounds, you know? So I love to watch and see how, she has two wonderful kids, you know? One time, Levi got on FaceTime, and he's, like, teaching me my colors, and he's just like any other, you know, three-year-old, four-year-old kid, you know? And I was like, wow, I thought the deaf kid would be this way. No, the deaf kid is a kid. And the last line in the play is, I'll help you if you'll help me. And that's what Lauren taught me. We don't go far enough to help each other. We don't go far enough, Democrats and Republicans, we don't go far enough to help each other. Blacks and whites, we don't go far enough to help each other. Deaf and hearing, we don't go far enough. We try to like, oh, you know, you do all the work. I'm going to stay over here while you learn how to be like me. You know what I didn't tell you, Bill? Lauren's husband in real life is he's deaf as well. And he is an international slam poet champ.
Really?
Yeah, you can imagine the first time I saw that. It's like, he's the, what? You how can, you don't speak. How could you do
can
poetry?
Can we find videos of him doing that?
Yeah, his name is Douglas Ridloff.
We will find a couple of videos of him doing his slam poetry and put them up on the Two-Way Street website.
Right. Douglas Ridloff.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more with Kenny Leon. Just joining us, my guest is Atlanta-based theater director Kenny Leon. This week, Kenny opens his 10th Broadway show, a revival of the 1980 play Children of a Lesser God. It tells the story of a deaf young woman and her love affair with a teacher of the deaf who is a fully hearing person. He believes the deaf have to learn to speak and read lips if they expect to survive in the hearing world. She resists his efforts to convince her of this, and eventually it leads to a shattering confrontation. This is William Hurt and Merrilee Maitland from the film of the play.
Until you let me be an I the way you are, you can never come inside my silence and know me. And I won't let myself know you.
Well, that's all very moving. But how are you going to manage? You can lock yourself back in your precious silent castle. And you know what? I think you're lying. I don't think that you think being deaf is so goddamn wonderful. I think that you're scared to death to try. I think that it is nothing but stupid pride that is keeping you from speaking right. You want to be on your own. You don't want to be pitied. Then you learn to read my lips. You want to talk to me. Then you learn my language. Did you understand that? Now come on. Speak to me. Speak. Speak to me.
William Hurt and Merrilee Maitland in the film production. Is that scene still played pretty much the same way in your stage production?
Yeah. You follow them all evening, and you want them to win. You want love to win. And then he pushes her too far, and he pushes her in a place that tries to make her like him instead of loving her on her own terms. And in that moment in the live theater, it's so ugly and beautiful and crazy and rich. But it's a moment that really, really plays. The interesting thing about our production, Lauren had not used her voice until since she was 10. And so when we did the workshop, you know, she told me that I have, you know, I've by choice, I've not used my voice, you know, because, and I understood her so clearly, it's because that's living life on someone else's term. Even if I said it beautifully, perfectly, I have no idea what that sounds like. Yeah. And so she said, so I don't know, it might be kind of emotional for me. I said, let's not do it in rehearsal. Let's wait till tomorrow and do it at when the investors are here. And we did it. And so none of the other actors, Joshua hadn't ever heard that. So when Lauren went there as the person and the character to that same place, yeah, it was doubly impactful. And then Joshua's crying, she's crying, 100 people in the room are crying. And of course, that's when everybody around said, we got to move this to Broadway right away. but because Lauren had went through this in real life, I really understood how powerful that moment is. And as a director, how specific I have to carve that moment, because it wasn't fake to me. It was real because Lauren had made that same choice in her life. Every time we rehearsed that scene, every time we did that play, it did not get easier. That scene did not get easier. But we had to keep figuring out ways to keep it fresh and to keep it, because you have to understand, she can't hear anything. She can't hear the audience response. If the audience is crying, she can't hear that, you know. And it's been the best rehearsal environment I've been in, because everybody's so truthful. I don't know what it is to be deaf. Lauren doesn't know what it is to be hearing. The Korean, Julie, doesn't know what it is to be African-American and a male. So we're learning the best of America in a rehearsal process. And it's made me a wiser person.
You've been a groundbreaker in a number of ways. And one of my favorite, I've seen a lot of your work, I'm really happy to be able to say.
And I appreciate that, Bill.
Well, and one of the shows that you did at True Colors Theater, your theater right here in Atlanta, a few years ago was Thornton Wilder's great, great drama, Our Town. And you said about that play that for a long time you didn't think that was something you could do. You didn't feel that was a play that was right for you. Why didn't you think it was right? And then what brought you around to deciding it was?
I always felt that Our Town was the high school play, and, you know, with the white people and the stage manager, and I never felt included because I never saw anybody in the play that looked like me. And I was like, oh, it's so bland, it's so boring. And then when I directed it here in Atlanta at True Colors, I diversified the cast, diversified the music, diversified the rituals, you know, because, you know, I think difference is beautiful. I think that when I go to a Jewish wedding and you guys like lift the chair and step on the glass, I'm like, oh, man, that's it. So when you go to, you know, our weddings, you know, we got Whitney Houston and Stevie Wonder and, you know, Precious Lord, Take My Hand. So I love the difference in cultures. And when I did Our Town and diversified it, then I saw me in it as a human being. And then the play, it resonated more as that's a play about the preciousness of moments on the planet. That's human. That's not racial. That's not cultural.
One of the most beautiful scenes in Our Town is Emily, the young woman, the protagonist, mm-hmm, in the play. We follow her story. She meets a young boy. They fall in love. They marry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she dies.
Mm-hmm.
She dies young.
Like we all will do.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to get out here alive.
And she comes back. She's given the opportunity to come back and see her town. And this is a part of what she says. This is Penelope Ann Miller in the Lincoln Center production, mm-hmm, of Our Town.
Goodbye, Grover's Corners. Mama. And Papa. Goodbye, the clock is ticking. And Mama's sunflowers. And food. And coffee. And new iron dresses. And hot baths. And sleeping. And waking up. Oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anybody to realize you. Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it? Every minute. I'm ready to go back.
Beautiful.
Oh, Kenny, it's a gorgeous moment of theater. And it struck me, one of the reasons I wanted to play it is because I know how completely passionate you are about the power of theater. And that scene is a great example of it. What is that kind of ineffable quality that makes us feel theater as deeply as we do? And when did it first hit you?
So for me, probably when I grown up with my grandmother in Tallahassee, Florida, and sitting in the Southern Baptist Church, when someone is singing a song that hits you on a level that you can't even articulate what made that happen, but when you feel it at your core, like when my mom was singing in the church and she would sing, "Precious Lord, Take My Hand." And whenever she would sing that song, it would move people in the church so that people would start shouting and jumping up. But it wasn't just they heard a pretty song. They felt the song on a spiritual level. So as when a human goes to a spiritual place, that's undeniable. So when you have a play that talks about something, so human and profound that everyone gets it, it's on a deep, deep, deep level. And when that happens in the theater, it's just gorgeous.
Do you remember what the first professional play was you saw?
No, I know the first Broadway.
What was your first Broadway show?
Fences by August Wilson.
Really? Was that the James Earl Jones production?
1987.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I grew up, I grew up poor in Florida. We didn't know what Broadway was. But then I did a play, my first play, I did a play called Son Gone Home with Angela Bassett in a program called Upward Bound. And then we did a lot of plays in church. I played Joseph and Pilate and, so Easter plays and all that. But I saw my first Broadway play in 1987. But when I saw that, I then knew that theater could be more than just entertainment. Because in that production with the great August Wilson, now I'm hearing, even though I'm from Florida, now I hear the rhythms of my grandmother. But it's from a family in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And then I see the ritual of my mother braiding my sister hair. So I see people doing the hair the way we did hair and sitting on the porch eating watermelon. And, so it's like, wow, my culture and my life is worthy of being on a raised stage in front of the whole community. And that was profound. And that sort of, a year later, I was associate artistic director at the Alliance Theater. So it gave my life purpose when you can see your life on stage. And no matter what people say, theater is not just entertainment. It's life on stage.
Yeah.
And it's the only art form where we're breathing the same air as the performers. You can't do that in the film. You can't do that watching television.
My first Broadway show was Mary Martin in The Sound of Music.
And how old were you?
I was trying to remember the year that show debuted. It was probably 1958. I was probably 11, 12 years old.
I just saw John Lithgow last week doing his show, and I realized watching his, I was like, wow, we have so many different experiences, because he went to the theater. He was like 3 years old, and his parents was taking him to the Broadway show. I was like, my play was sitting on the porch watching people pass by and watching cars pass by. That's theater.
And who would have thought, as you sat there and watched James Earl Jones in 87, I think you said, playing that incredible role, that years later you would be directing Denzel Washington in that same play. I was, again, fortunate enough to see that production of Fences, and it was one of my, we all have peak experiences in theater.
Yeah.
And that was one of them.
Yeah, it's quite amazing to, in 1987, to sit and watch the great James Earl Jones and Courtney Vance, and then in 2010 to be on Broadway at the Court Theater to not only direct Denzel Washington and Viola Davis and Stephen McKinley
Henderson, who won the Tony for her part in that, didn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah, and the play won too. But also to do August Wilson on Broadway. That's pretty amazing.
as we bring the conversation to a close, you said that you, as the director of Children of a Lesser God, believe there's hope for those two characters to come back together, to love each other, to be together.
I think there's hope in the play. If you ask me, my specific belief is that they will become better people. I don't think they'll come back together as a couple. It's like someone, actually Denzel Washington says this. He said, you know, people think God doesn't answer every prayer, but he does. Sometimes the answer is no.
So take that to a larger stage. How much hope do you have right now in the ability of we as Americans to come together in the midst of all of the hatred, the partisanship, the polarization?
Yeah. From Africa to America, from slave ships to civil rights to young black men being killed, to all that, I still have hope.
Why?
I have hope that we get better because of the good in people. I've seen the good in individuals.
It's my observation as we close. Your whole career has been built around just that, believing in the good in people, and your desire to contribute to that as much as you can. That seems to be what your whole career has been about.
Yeah, but it's also as a man, as a person, that's what I see.
Yeah.
That's what I know we're better when we sit next to each other and we're different. You know, when we embrace all people and embrace all people without walls, it works.
We posted information about Kenny Leon's production of Children of a Lesser God on the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. We've also posted information about the theater that Kenny founded right here in Atlanta, True Colors. We're going to take a break now. When we come back, more on Two Way Street. Welcome back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. As I mentioned earlier in today's show, Kenny Leon won his Tony Award for his production of Raisin in the Sun in 2014. It's an iconic piece of American theater and tells the story of a crisis in the lives of an African-American family on the South Side of Chicago. It was written by Lorraine Hansberry, who grew up on the South Side, and put her experiences there into the story of the younger family. That reminded me of a conversation we recorded about the poet Gwendolyn Brooks. She, too, grew up on the South Side of Chicago. Her poems were deeply informed by the people who lived around her there. Brooks was one of the most influential and highly regarded poets of the 20th century. She was the first African-American author to win a Pulitzer Prize and was the Poet Laureate of Illinois. I talked about her life and work with Quraysh Ali Lansana. He studied poetry with Brooks and is one of the editors of a volume called Revise the Psalm. It's a collection of poems and essays by writers who took their inspiration from the works of Gwendolyn Brooks.
Miss Brooks in the 50s created a construct, a form, a poetic form that she called verse journalism. And she only gave us two definitions, really, of the form. And those definitions are poet as all-seeing eye and poet as fly on the wall. Miss Brooks published her first poem at 13, A Song in the Front Yard, which is the persona poem of a young girl who wants to leave the front yard and go in the back where the charity children play, where the poor children who don't have stability, they're not stability in their life, there aren't boundaries in their lives, but it looks like to a young girl who can't leave the yard that those poor children out running about would have a kind of freedom that the young girl desired.
So let's listen to Gwendolyn Brooks reciting that poem herself.
I've stayed in the front yard all my life. I want to peek at the back, where it's rough and untended and hungry weed grows. A girl gets sick of a rose. I want to go in the backyard now and maybe down the alley to where the charity children play. I want a good time today. They do some wonderful things. They have some wonderful fun. My mother sneers, but I say it's fine how they don't have to go in at 8:45. My mother, she tells me that Johnny May will grow up to be a bad woman, that George will be taken to jail soon or late on account of last winter he sold our back gate. But I say it's fine, honest I do, and I'd like to be a bad woman too and wear the brave stockings of night black lace and strut down the streets with paint on my face.
Here she has a father who's a janitor and a mother who's not only a school teacher but a classically trained pianist, I think.
Right.
So both of those currents run through her and inform her view of the world beyond.
Absolutely. And because, you know, Miss Brooks, again, raised on the Black South Side and died on the Black South Side, even at the height of her career when she could have easily moved to a more affluent community or even a more diverse community, say, on the North Side, or even more affluent communities on the South Side, she stayed in the heart of Black Chicago because for the entirety of her life and the entirety of her career, the Black community was her passion, her fodder, her muse, and her audience for her work. Her work was rooted in the stories and the pains and the experience of Black folks in Chicago and in urban America. And I would say that with the exception of Studs Terkel, the great journalist, who was, of course, a very close friend of Miss Brooks's, that Miss Brooks is certainly the most significant chronicler of Black Chicago that exists.
I think a lot of people love her poem, We Real Cool.
Sure.
For a lot of reasons. First of all, it speaks to her understanding of the plight of young Black men growing up in the ghetto of Chicago. Tell us what that poem talks about.
One day, she got off the bus near 75th and Cottage Grove and passed a bar and pool hall called Blaylock's The Golden Shovel in the middle of the afternoon and saw some young people who should have been in high school, who should have been in school at that hour, hanging out, drinking gin or, you know, drinking and shooting pool. And they were a crew. So she thought, when she looked through the window at these young men, she thought, instead of writing from the vantage point as an adult, thinking about what these kids should be doing, she thought, I'll flip that and think, I wonder what they think of themselves.
She put herself in their skins.
Right.
Let's listen to Morgan Freeman recite that poem.
We real cool. The pool players. Seven at the Golden Shovel. We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We thin gin. We jazz June. We die soon.
Morgan Freeman, we die soon. And she's telling us that that's what she imagines they're thinking about their lives, that there's nowhere for them to go. So given that what you've done in your collection is to have other poets, contemporary poets, interpret, revise the Psalm, revise Gwendolyn Brooks' work, you have a poem by Adrienne Christian called Dog in a Dead Man's House. And this is a poem that Adrienne Christian wrote with We Real Cool in mind. And we're not going to recite the whole poem, but it basically, it's the same themes. I was a dog in a dead man's house. I was a tooth in a dead man's mouth. I was a rat in a family den. I was a hog in a horse's pen. And it goes on in a very similar way,
right,
describing the dead-end lives of young black men in poor neighborhoods.
Right.
She spent a considerable amount of time working with what was essentially a black gang on the south side of Chicago, the Blackstone Rangers.
Right.
And what did she do with the Blackstone Rangers, who to many of us, whether we're in the white community or in the middle class and more privileged black community, would consider folks who were dangerous and we wanted to stay far away from?
Right. Miss Brooks was asked by the great singer, songwriter, composer, actor Oscar Brown Jr. to assist him, work with him on the creation of a musical called Opportunity Please Knock. And so Big Oscar, as those of us who were close enough and fortunate enough to know him, refer to him. Big Oscar had created this workshop at a church on the South Side and asked Miss Brooks to help him with the language, help him work with the Blackstone Rangers in the actual language for the musical. And so she did.
Another theme that was very important to her was the way in which black women and black mothers were trying to navigate a world which was not particularly kind or welcoming to them. Let's listen to Ruby Dee read just a little bit of one of her truly most famous, I think it's fair to say, and powerful poems called The Mother. It's a powerful poem because if you want an example of just how powerless a woman might feel, it's in the moment in which she, for whatever reason, realizes she cannot bring a child into the world, whether it's because she's living in poverty, doesn't have a husband to support her, whatever the circumstances, it makes that poem so powerful.
Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damn small popes with little or no hair. The singers and workers that never handle the air. You will never neglect or beat them, or silence or buy with a sweet. You will never wind up these sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. You will never leave them controlling your luscious sigh and we return for a snack of them, the gobbling mother eye.
I think there are a couple of things to note regarding that poem. Number one, that yes, this poem is the fourth poem, I believe, in A Street in Bronzeville, her first book published in 1945. So just let that resonate for a moment. This is a poem, a persona poem, in the voice of a woman. Though there's no particular ethnicity present in the poem, we would generally assume that she's a black woman of poverty, living in poverty, who'd experienced multiple abortions, and Miss Brooks wrote a poem about her experience. The poem is the workings of the interior of the mind of a woman forced to make these kinds of challenging decisions about whether to keep a human life or their child or not.
Yeah.
And again, I can't emphasize enough, this was 1945. This was decades before the conversation about legalizing abortion was in the public discourse.
That is so important, because what that mother in her poem is contemplating is probably a dangerous procedure in a dark apartment somewhere in a doctor's office who's operating after hours illegally. This is not a simple decision to make. And perhaps makes the notion of losing that baby and being haunted by it even more meaningful.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. Another important backstory to this poem in particular is that Richard Wright, the novelist and essayist.
Native son, among other things.
Right. And her editor at Harper & Row, Elizabeth Lawrence, both told her that the country was not ready for this poem. And Miss Brooks said, "The poem stays or I pull the project." Now, just think about that for a moment.
Yeah.
This is a first book with a major powerhouse of New York publishing. And a, you know, relatively known poet from the Midwest in terms of being known in the Midwest, but in terms of a national scope, not so much.
In 1969, Gwendolyn Brooks was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for her second book of poetry, Annie Allen, which basically told the story in a series of poems of a young black woman coming into her own and raising her conscious awareness of the world around her. I think that's a fair way of describing it in general. But there's a very famous story about her winning the Pulitzer Prize. She told it many times in her life. And I think it says something about the world in which she was living as she was developing her career as a poet. Here's what she tells us, and you know this story well, but here's Gwendolyn Brooks describing what happened when she won her Pulitzer Prize. The question she is asked is, where were you when you heard the news you'd won the Pulitzer?
I was in a house at 9134 Wentworth, and the lights were out. That's been told many times by now. We hadn't paid the electric bill, so there was no electricity. And it was dusk, so it was dark in the house. My son was 9 at the time. Jack Starr, a reporter on the Sun-Times, called. So he said, do you know that you have won the Pulitzer Prize? And I said, no, and screamed over the telephone. I couldn't believe it. So he said, well, it was true. And it would be announced the next day. The next day, reporters came, photographers came with cameras, and I was absolutely petrified. I wasn't going to say anything about the electricity. I knew that when they put in their... when they tried to attach their cameras and all, nothing was going to happen. However, miraculously, somebody had turned the electricity back on that fast. I've never known exactly what happened. So my son and I danced around in the dusk and decided we'd go out to the movies to celebrate.
What a wonderful image.
It's a great story.
Her and her son first dancing around. But here she was, the winner of a Pulitzer Prize, and she was still living the life that many of the people she was writing about were living, which was a life of want in that period of time.
That's correct. And the other, and to add to that, right, is that the community that loved her, the community in which she was a part of from birth till death, the community found a way to get that electricity on because one of their own was being honored. And I think that that is also just as miraculous, right? That that is the way that we must love one another right now.
Quaresh Ali Lansana is an editor of Revising the Psalm, work celebrating the writing of Gwendolyn Brooks. It's a collection of poems and essays by writers whose work for the book was inspired by Brooks' poems. Gwendolyn Brooks was born in Topeka, Kansas, but her family moved to the south side of Chicago when she was only about 3 months old. She loved Chicago so much that her biographers report she always regretted not being able to call herself a native Chicagoan. But it was in her Chicago home that Brooks died in December of 2000. If you check out our Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS, or go to our Facebook page, you can hear again Brooks reading her poem, A Song in the Front Yard, which we played during my conversation with Quaresh. And although we played a version of We Real Cool, performed by Morgan Freeman, we've posted a link where you can hear Brooks reading the poem herself. We're just about out of time for today's show. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast and never miss Two-Way Street. Or you can go to our website where you can listen to any of the shows we've produced since we went on the air almost 4 years ago. Our senior producer is Jenny Amond. Our producer is Olivia Reingold. Olivia and Jenny edited this week's show. Tyler Morris is our engineer. I'm Bill Nigut. Have a great week.